Duncan MacLeod, and you're listening to the Tech Central podcast. I'm on an internet call now to rural Northern California for a discussion that I know is going to be of great interest to listeners of the show. On the line is none other than Mr. Ari Khan, the man who has laid claim to being the real inventor of the Please Call Me service in South Africa. Khan, who was contracted to MTN 2 decades ago, not only says he came up with the idea for Please Call Me, but patented it before Vodacom and that whole court battle that took place between Nkosana Makate and his former employer Vodacom over compensation for coming up with the idea. And that, of course, has been a bit of a farce. Ari, welcome to the podcast. It's great to chat to you again after so long.
Yes, likewise. Thank you, Duncan. I appreciate the opportunity.
No, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on. We appreciate it as well. So what I'm hoping we can do with this podcast is really set out the timeline of events as they happened over the past 2 decades or so and provide some greater insight into exactly what transpired in this case over the past 15, 18 years or so. But let's go right back to the beginning. Ari, you were involved with an entity called MTN Airborne. I remember you had offices separate from MTN Group, and you were quite independent, I think, of MTN. What was Airborne exactly, and what were you guys tasked with doing?
Yeah, you know, we were – initially when I approached MTN, I was quite a young, wild child and basically met the CEO and said, you know what, I'm the smallest operator in the world, and you have the vehicle to market. Let's play together. Mm-hmm. And I was afforded an – unbelievable opportunity because my only mandate really was to innovate. And I was given carte blanche access to every aspect of the operator. Remember in the early days, we were talking about a company of maybe 50 to 100 people. Mm. So I could walk into operations, billing, sales, marketing. I had free access to all C-level executives up to the chairman. I really, really had a dream job at MTN. It was a phenomenal time, and obviously cellular was very new in South Africa. So it was a time of a lot of excitement and a lot of new technologies coming into the fold. And basically, as I mentioned, my only mandate was to go and innovate and dream and deliver. So from the very beginning, this was towards the late 1990s, very few people had even heard of patents and intellectual property. But I had a very keen sense early on that we were entering the 21st century, which was the knowledge era, right? Mm-hmm. And I was set out to build an intellectual property portfolio for MTN and for the group. Mm-hmm. And singularly was responsible for recording a series of intellectual property. And my modus operandi, which back 20 years is the same to this very day, is, you know, dream something up, then record it, protect it, and deliver it. And this is where I think a lot of people don't have a good sense of what intellectual property and patent are all about. But essentially, Duncan, a patent is actually a very simple thing. It's about recording a recipe. And most people, between an idea and a product and a technology, is a universe apart. Right. I mean, ideas are a dime a dozen, but to actually reduce it to something that you can deliver to the world can be a very long and you know, exacting path. And that is the whole startup culture. People have ideas. They form new companies. They build on the ideas, deploy the technology. It's never, I have this light bulb moment and all of a sudden I've got a technology for the world. It doesn't happen that way. So, back in the day, I was looking at new technologies. And again, a great misnomer in my view is that innovation doesn't come really out of crystal ball gazing. You know, a word to the young dreamers, all you have to really do is pay attention to things that frustrate you. Mm-hmm. Because that's the way the universe kind of like taps you on the shoulder to get your attention, right? Mm-hmm. And then to just... And then just to take a moment and reflect on that and go deeper and uncover the true value of your idea. But that can take time and it requires discipline. So back in MTN and sometimes innovation, you stumble upon things. Things you create and the way the market perceives them are not one and the same thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But at MTN, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I mean, you landed this dream job at MTN Airborne. I mean, how did that happen? What were you doing before that? Were you a student before that? Were you working in corporate before joining MTN Airborne? And what were you an engineer by background? What did you study?
No, I started off studying medicine for a couple of years.
Oh, yeah.
And I can hear a plane flying. Right. You think it's the reconnaissance already.
Surprised it's not the Joburg Hardy Dars, which usually yes. bomb the podcast. Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, you know, if you think it's easy getting into medicine, if you think it's hard getting into medicine, try and get out of medicine. You know. A lot of peer social pressure. But after 2.5 years, I realized this was not my view of health. So I left. I was at UCT at the time. I left medicine and I started computer science. And I graduated with a computer science degree. And then I entered honors year. I went 3/4 way through honors. And I connected up with Anglo-American, funnily enough. And a guy by the name of Neil Pendock, who was doing phenomenal research into remote sensing, where they would take pictures and images from space to the Earth, and they would plot trends and do geological surveying without actually digging up the ground. And I had a wonderful year or two of learning about mainframe systems, etc. My forte, the gift that I was given was programming. Programming to me in mathematics was like music, right? Mm-hmm. I was versed in 11 or 12 languages, my favorite being APL, which was, you know, the language used by actuarial scientists. In fact, my major project at WITS was done in APL but had to be given to IBM because the professors couldn't read the language. So that was I left honors because I enjoyed the work at Anglo, and I went into the Air Force for 2 years.
Oh, wow.
I was the very last kind of candidate who would ever go into the military. But I went, and a phenomenal thing happened. I managed to get seconded to the CSIR, which is a very rare thing. Maybe like 5 people out of the entire intake would be seconded to the CSIR for research, right?
Right.
And over the 2 years when I was leaving the Air Force, they thought I was coming in because I was in civilian clothes. I had long hair. I never actually went, you know, and it was phenomenal. Anyway, so I worked for the Aeronautics Institute. I was developing software for engineers to visualize systems. And then I continued my work with Anglo-American Geophysical Remote Sensing. I developed some of the very, very first geographical user interface to an IBM PC. Now, we're talking back in the day where there weren't even graphical libraries. I was programming in assembler code.
Wow.
And created almost like a Windows Macintosh interface to software that was eventually used at WITS for teaching aids. And fast-forwarding a little bit, I worked as an individual for a couple of years, and then I attended an exposition in Johannesburg in 1994 where cellular was just coming into South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And at that exposition, I met somebody who was talking about the technology, et cetera, and she said, you know, why don't you come and meet some of the guys back at the network, which I did. And that was the very beginning days, was John Beck was the CEO.
I remember John, yes.
Yeah. Funnily enough, I outlasted 3 CEOs.
MTN's had a lot of CEOs over the years, hasn't it?
they have, yeah. But and I basically said, you know, I said to John, you know, I started work. He liked the pitch, and then after him came Bob Chaffee, which was an ex-SBC American guy, and he was very like, you know, the Americans understand innovation, etc. So it was just a perfect sequence of events that laid this foundation for me to get schooled in telecommunications. I didn't know anything about telecoms.
Mm-hmm.
Everything I've learned about telecoms, I learned in the lion's den, so to speak. So which is very unusual in corporate South Africa, is the ability to have such an informal process where you can basically meet with executives in the hallway on their way to other meetings, pitch ideas, get engineers to support you, and just play and deliver things to market without going through 101 checklists, right?
Mm.
And that was very unusual at the time. And I happened to stumble upon some big hits and big wins, which kind of seated myself in the role of the lead innovator within the group. And one of those hits at the time was a very simple service called mtnsms.com. I'm sure you recall that service.
I do. I used it quite extensively back in the day, actually.
Right. And, I mean, you know, the world is so complex, but one thing that people really always value and love is simplicity. Mm-hmm. And the path to simplicity is extraordinarily complex. Yeah. I can throw something very complex together in 5 minutes, but to distill it down to its essence can take a long time. And at the time, sending a message was not that easy on a cell phone. Most cell phones actually didn't even support picking out a message. There was no business model behind it. So I came across this notion, it'll be great to let people sit at their PC and type a message and have it delivered on their phone.
Yeah.
And this was the beginning of the space that I became very well versed in. It was the space between PCs and cell phones, or the convergence between wired and wireless. And that's actually still a very, very prominent space today. But anyway, mtnsms.com was a yellow, MTN bright yellow screen, typed your message, hit send, and within 2 seconds, cell phones around the world was beeping, right? Mm. And because we leveraged all the interconnects with all the global carriers.
Yes, yes. It was hugely popular. And I mean, how many messages were being sent across that platform at the peak?
We sent over 1 billion messages in the first 12 months. And wow. We had 7.5 million users who was all organic by word of mouth. And this was the very beginning of my understanding and appreciation of viral service. And by that, I mean, when you send a message to a person, at the bottom of the message, It told them where it came from, right? So yeah. It kind of like looped itself back. And MTN SMS was an absolute phenomenon. Duncan, it was this little web page, this branded MTN color. I would go around the world often on trips and you would see in someone's office, you would see a yellow screen.
Yes.
And the brand value, you know, that little service elevated MTN from a local to a global brand. That was just phenomenal.
Yeah. What killed it in the end? There was a lot of pushback, wasn't there, from operators?
Ultimately, it was a two-way messaging system. So you could reply from your cell phone back to the PC kind of like as an inbox. But ultimately, what did damage the service was the intermediary operator started charging for the signaling between MTN But nevertheless, you know, not everything is for one of the great brand guys in South Africa, Mike Friedman, who also worked at Airborne. He had this great saying, which was some for show, some for dough, you know, and mtnsms.com wasn't a revenue spinner, but it was a great brand awareness platform that people could talk about and get to see innovation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, you know, the irony of it is that I was so naive with all these things. I didn't know what was possible and what was not possible.
Yeah.
And mtnsms.com was run on one Microsoft server. One server was serving 25 messages a second, 1 billion over the year, 7.5 million users. And it got the attention of some very big players. Like in the USA, there was a new startup called sms.ca for California, funnily enough.
Right.
And They heard about the service and they came out to, they wanted to meet us and find out how we were doing it. It was like a delegation of 6 people came to visit us and they said, you know, can you show us your server farm? And I said, server farm? What do you mean?
Well, it's a good ad for Microsoft if you were running this global platform of one Microsoft server.
We had our challenges with them as well. But yes, in essence, I said to them, what server farm? They said, what's your infrastructure? We've got one server in the back room here running the entire site. They had 100 farm and they'd yet to send. It was and that was the, that became my DNA. My DNA has always been ultra minimalism, shoestring deployments, planetary scale. And yeah. I've continued that since I've left South Africa and MTN.
Right.
You can do phenomenal things extremely lightweight if you design with scale from the beginning.
Yeah. Well, I want to
just quickly pass. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, I was going to say I want to talk a bit about what you're up to now, and I know you're working on a very interesting project, but we'll talk about a bit more about that later in the podcast. But maybe we should dive into the Call Me service now, and maybe let's start right at the beginning, Ari. Let's talk about how you came up with this idea. What was the genesis of it, and how was it put into effect?
Okay, I won't go too deep, but I'll give you the salient points.
Sure.
In November, middle of November, you know, being in a fairly high profile position, I was getting a tremendous amount of phone calls, you know, mm-hmm. because of the newness of cellular data and all this. And it was extremely frustrating for me because every phone message that was left, you have to go and access voicemail, and the last message is at the end rather than the first. And it's just a lot of sweat to actually get through your voicemail. Yeah. Everyone knows that, right?
Yeah.
And what came out of voicemail was the simple thing that 70% of my voicemails, people were saying, "Hi, this is John, call me." And I thought to myself, there has to be a better way for people to tell me to call them. And dreaming about this once late at night, it dawned on me that instead of people phoning my phone, ringing, disturbing me, going to voicemail, leaving me this message that I then have to go and it's a very analog process. It's a very time-consuming process. What if I allow people to just dial a short code in front of a phone number so it differentiates the call from a regular call, and then the network sends a bespoke message on their behalf?
Mm-hmm.
And that was a light bulb to me because, again, at the time, very few people knew how to originate a text. Everyone knew how to dial a phone number. Everyone knew how to read a text. Because remember, the beginning of SMS was voicemail notification. You have one new voicemail. Do you remember that?
I do. Thankfully, people don't seem to use voicemail anymore.
Exactly. So the ability to a kind of hybrid dial numbers and spin text messages to me was a very compelling proposition because it delivered what I termed ring-free technology.
Yeah.
You didn't ring the phone. You delivered something else, right?
Yeah.
So that to me was really, really exciting. And again, just a note to aspiring innovators. When something excites you, take notice, right?
Yeah.
It's important, but don't share it too quickly. But the next day I went to brief Spoor and Fisher because, again, that was my method of operation: dream, record, protect, and deliver. So I briefed them. I said, "I want you to file a patent on this new ring-free technology, which is dial a little code followed by the number and then deliver a network message dependent on that code." And that was the genesis of Call Me, because people were asking me to call me on my voicemail. So I developed a simpler, faster method of asking somebody to call you.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting.
And that's where the name came from.
It's interesting you decided to patent it. I think many innovators don't think that far ahead. They come up with a fantastic idea. They build the product, take it to market, and then the lawyers eventually come along and say, "Hey, why haven't you patented this?" You actually decided the moment you thought of this idea that I have to patent this. It's a bit unusual, isn't it?
It's unusual, but I knew at the time that that intellectual property was going to be the gold of the 21st century knowledge era.
Mm-hmm.
I'd come to this realization and I decided that I would rather err on the side of caution. And really the ultimate lesson of Call Me is that small things can be tremendously valuable and powerful.
Mm.
And that was borne out. Yeah, that was a 10-page patent that generated tens of billions, you know, $1 billion per page. Not too shabby, you know, for a patent.
How do you determine how much it generated as a matter of interest?
Well, the simple fact is, I mean, I have a lot of research into the space, and typically when somebody asks you to call them back,
yeah,
30% call within the 1 hour, 50% within 12 hours, and 75% will return a call within the 24-hour period. So it is a generator in terms of if you are stimulating inbound traffic that ordinarily wouldn't happen because you didn't have air. Again, Call Me was made free of charge. So not only did you not have to phone somebody, leave a voicemail, not only did you not have to type a message, incidentally, another unknown little factoid is that I was tasked to develop the business case for SMS and came up with the 75 cents per message. And a lot of people are going to want to clap me. at the time, you know, 75 cents versus R2.60 for a call, a lot quicker. But the bottom line is call me was free. And yes, therein was the magic.
Yes.
And the magic is, I don't know if you're familiar with the notion of the penny gap, Duncan,
no,
in that the penny gap was a strategy developed by a guy named Josh Koppelman. He's with First Round Capital. And he came to this amazing realization that the biggest gap in service is between one that costs a penny and one that's given away free.
Mm.
Because free is psychological. It's what everyone desires. I mean, imagine if Google charged you a penny for every search. It wouldn't be on page 1,000 of Bing. You know, it just wouldn't be around. So the penny gap has actually been a central theme of my journey post MTN as well. This notion that free and 1 cent are universes apart. And so the call me process was simple. I'd already built a lot of Lego building blocks in Airborne, and I assembled it in one day. And again, it was on this time it wasn't on a server. This was on a desktop Pentium PC. and you dial this number, it routed to the PC. PC took your A and B, took the source number, took the code, it looked up a message in the database, it spun an SMS, call me. And then again, it did something which is the first time ever. It passed itself forward with instruction. It said how to send a call me. So the receiver was told how to send one himself.
Mm.
And honestly, Duncan, people talk today about viral services. This was viral 2 to the power of N. Within 3 days, 1.5 million people had used the service. I mean, it was just phenomenal. At first, I thought it was a technical error. I thought that we'd had an infinite loop and we were just spinning messages out of control. But no, this was real. These were real people spinning call me's.
And this is all running again. This is all running on a Pentium.
Running on a desktop PC, because I mean, really, it's quite a lightweight thing. You just got the A and B number and you spun off a message. I mean, it wasn't really compute intensive, right?
Sure, sure.
And then then what happened was when finance got to see this incredible uptake, I mean, bear in mind, Facebook took 10 months to get its first 1 million users, right? We're talking 1 million users in 72 hours.
Mm.
Call me was the most virally uptaked service in the history of cellular and internet, even to this day. That's the institution and the phenomenon we're talking about.
So it tapped into a real need by end users who didn't have airtime or airtime poor, who needed to get hold of people, but they just couldn't afford to do so at the rates at the time. And there was that demand, that need for ordinary consumers to be able to communicate, but they couldn't afford to, so the Please Call Me service solved that problem.
But that was, again, you know, to be completely candid, that is not what I envisaged the service to be. I'm not claiming I did.
What did you envisage it to be?
I envisaged it for way people to ask somebody to call them. I did not at the time understand. This is what I say. Sometimes we stumble into enlightenment. I did not understand that the youth of South Africa had discovered a way to free speech.
Mm-hmm.
They would send call me's and get people to call them back. They weren't saying, you know, they weren't. But then again, it was the entire market. It was the young people not wanting to pay for calls. It was people, you know, it was guys driving 7 Series BMWs who were too tight to pay for a call to their girlfriend. It was people sending messages to boardroom, to people sending messages to chairmen in boardrooms so they didn't want to disturb them. It was the entire gamut.
Right.
But the viral nature of the service and the unknown need that it hit in the marketplace was unparalleled.
Mm, mm. So when was this launched? What was the date of launch of the call me service on the MTN network?
Okay, so dreamt on the 15th of November, and the 16th of November, the attorneys have in their scheduled calendar events, AK coming to brief them on call me, right? Ari Khan coming to brief them on call me. And then the next day I developed it, prototyped it in an hour, spent a couple of days polishing it. This was getting towards the end of the year. So there was, people have this notion that, yeah, this guy Khan got this idea, rushed to the patent office. There was no such thing. The attorneys were 2 months later, after coming back from the new year, they filed the patent on the 22nd of January. And in the meantime, I was showing a few select people around MTN this really cool way to spin a message, cautioning them, don't show it to anybody because we don't have protection. And the moment we filed the application on the 22nd of January, we launched the 23rd because it was ready to go.
Yeah. Okay. And when did you first get an inclination that something was going on at Vodacom?
When they launched a couple of weeks later.
Right.
And then, you know, I thought, how, you know, that just astounded me because, you know, it just sounded too close to call. And that's when everything kind of started going haywire. But maybe this is a good opportunity then to just rewind the Kenneth McCarthy story.
Sure.
And how kind of that dovetailed.
Sure.
Okay, so a couple of things. Firstly, Kenneth had a bright idea. He wanted to allow people who didn't have airtime to buzz in his memo. It's all in the memo, right?
Mm-hmm.
To basically send a missed call to another user. That was his original idea that he proposed to Vodacom.
Right.
And in this story, there are three key defining moments where this whole case should have been thrown out of the back. So he goes to Vodacom and says, hey, I've got this idea. Can you deliver it and can you allow me to share in its rewards, right? And Vodacom says, okay, let's see firstly if it's technically feasible and secondly, if it's commercially viable or a success, right?
Mm.
Technically feasible was the first gate of that verbal contract, which was never passed. Because he went to Vodacom and said, listen, let's just give an analogy. He said, can you bake me this chocolate cake? And the engineers went away and they said, actually, we don't have the ingredients and we don't have the recipe, but listen, we'll come back with this milk tat or this apple pie, which was not what he proposed.
Hmm.
And at that moment in time, if Vodacom had said to him, or the Geisler, the guy that he was dealing with, he said, listen, your proposal is not technically feasible, that whole story would have shut down right there because that was the first condition. But but he let it slide because when he saw 3 weeks later the USSD messaging service or this dialing a code followed by a number to send a message rather than to deposit a missed call, he stayed silent on that because he probably felt, oh, maybe this is a better idea. So what he proposed to Vodacom, they did not develop. They developed something that had a similar outcome or desired result, but it was not what he proposed. And that was the beginning of the departure of Kenneth McCarthy's story.
Interesting.
Secondly,
yeah.
Secondly, when MTN served Vodacom with infringement, instead of Vodacom saying, okay, you got us, you were first, you got the recipe, you beat us to market, no, they went into this complete denial spin, which emboldened Kenneth McCarthy and enabled him. Because now Vodacom was saying, actually, no, MTN's was not first, was not prior. WeakMind was saying, yours was first, yours was original. But it wasn't, obviously, because, as I said, his original proposal was never developed. That was the second strike. If Vodacom had just said and acknowledged, okay, MTN, you beat us to market. This is your technology. Let's talk about some licensing opportunity. The story would have gone away. It didn't. And then going forward, the third strike that did not wipe this case out was through the courts, where the wrong patent was led as evidence and false testimony was given around it because there was this notion that the MTN service was going through an IVR where users had to dial, follow a prompt, enter the B number. I mean, who would drive masses into IVR hell? That was certainly not my technology. And that came out because they were referencing the wrong patent.
Which patent were they referencing?
they were referencing another technology that I developed. Remember, too, I was developing several technologies. I maybe had half a dozen patents registered.
Oh, I see.
And Kenneth actually recently on a social media posting, he acknowledged it. He said, here's the patent. He had a photograph of it taken, all highlighted in red pen. And he said, the court dismissed this as a technology different to Please Call Me. Well, hello. Yes, of course it was different. It was the wrong patent.
So MTN, I believe, wrote lawyers' letters to Vodacom about the launch of the Please Call Me service on the Vodacom platform. What happened there? I mean, clearly there was a legal dispute that erupted, but eventually it seemed it was squashed. What transpired?
Okay, well, MTN recently put out a statement that, you know, they were focused on building the market, and then I think the comment was patent law was complex. That was their comment, and they didn't want to get involved. And I have to take a little bit of – we need to just unpack that for a moment. As I said, patent law is not complex. It's very simple. Who filed first, and are you copying my recipe? That's it.
Now you
don't have to know patent law to make it simple. There are attorneys and law firms who do this for their living. So the notion that MTN didn't want to fight this because patent law was complex is a little bit disingenuous, right? There was, I mentioned to you that, you know, the arrogance, egos, and the competitive spirit is not only outward facing.
Yeah.
Within a carrier, there are lots of egos and a lot of competition. And one of the things I came to realize very quickly during my journey at MTN is the not invented here syndrome. Was very powerful. Here you had this young outsider coming into the network den and creating all these new technologies, getting a little bit of recognition, getting massive successes. It upset some people. You know, not everyone was for my developments at MTN.
Interesting.
And the not invented here, and again, specifically, and I mean, I understand that. It's completely understandable. Here you have... You know, a network operation is like an army. It's very, very militant. You've got to have order and discipline. You've got to roll out base stations. You've got to, you know, you can't just have some young guy running around doing his own thing. It follows an exact procedure and protocol. And these guys who build the network very often don't get the recognition. But then you have somebody in marketing or innovation that comes up with an idea that sits on top of all their labor and potentially gets all the recognition. You can understand there is some friction in the company, right?
Yeah. But there was suggestions that Vodacom shareholder Venfin was somehow involved in trying to sort this situation out. There were a lot of behind the scenes haggling and negotiations between Vodacom parties and MTN parties to resolve this. Do you have insight into some of that stuff and what transpired behind the scenes?
Okay, this is the only part of my story that I'm sharing secondhand information to.
Okay.
Everything else is firsthand.
All right.
And the secondhand information came from the Spur and Fisher attorneys. Mm-hmm. They said they're under tremendous pressure because the Rembrandt Group is one of their clients, and this is becoming such a big story. It's worth billions of rands because they saw the massive uptake. Again, just a quick sidestep here, Duncan. Do you know the phenomenon about mobile is that where in business do you have thousands of people banging on your door even before you're ready to go to market? Mm-hmm. That was the pent-up desire of mobile. People were reserving their phone numbers before there was service. Very, very rare in business do you have such a demand. So when a service takes off like a rocket, like this did, and everyone sits and takes notice, they understood what was at play, that there were billions of rands at stake here, and they were not about to acquiesce to MTN's demands and acknowledge that what they delivered wasn't their own. So, the proverbial battle of titans and egos, but ultimately – through a lot of pressure on people's careers and even livelihoods, I was told directly that lives and livelihoods were threatened, that MTN with their counsel, etc., they decided this wasn't a fight they were ready to pick. And ultimately, it did, you know, maybe it was for the better, maybe it wasn't. But there was also the component within MTN, you know, is that this young guy, Khan, is now going to beholden us to huge royalties and et cetera because of this runaway success. There were many, many different angles to why this didn't go through the courts. My feeling is obviously it should have gone through the courts. It would have been a slam dunk, you know, but it never did.
For whatever reason. And it's really speculation. Yeah. But MTN allowed the patent to lapse. I think it was in 2007. Was that a mistake?
That was shocking to me to actually see that because, I mean, we are talking about $100 a year. It might even be 100 rand a year to keep patents alive. You pay an annuity every year. And that really, to me, was almost willful destruction of property.
Why do you think they did it? Or didn't do it?
I really can't. I think maybe because they were all nervous of this individual who might come back knocking on their door. You know, given the way this thing had spun out into the marketplace and that, I think they were all just a little bit vulnerable because there was this history, there was this patent, there was this massive business that came out of it. Now, what if this guy comes knocking on our door saying, you know what, this patent has generated so much revenue for you as a company, I want a share. I didn't take that route. That's the route Kenneth took, and he didn't have the legal standing to do that.
Yeah.
But just quickly to circle back, Duncan, those three strike points. His proposal was never developed. Vodacom denied rather than acquiesced. And thirdly, the court ruled on false evidence and testimony. Bear in mind that the Concord does not hear new evidence and testimony. The Constitutional Court really just reviews the High Court. Right. They don't relitigate the case. So their review was based on false testimony. And ultimately, if you just summarize this entire process up, what do we have? We have the simple fact is that the only document, disregarding everything in the court record, the only document that is irrefutable is the document in the patent office. Here you have an individual saying, claiming title to an invention he never invented, demanding rewards and compensation for property he doesn't own. You know, we don't need a thesaurus to know what fraud and theft looks like. That is intellectual property fraud. And that, in my view, is the real constitutional matter at hand because it contravenes universally accepted and ratified law governing knowledge creation. Who has prior art? And that is why I believe the Constitutional Court urged this was not about a promise made because, as I mentioned to you, the very first thing, is it technically feasible? It was not. That contract was null and void. And then not only was it not feasible, it belonged to somebody else. So without making Kenneth look like this villain, people have said, you know, is Kenneth McCarthy victim or villain, right? Unfortunately, he's a little bit of both. He was a young guy, naive in the process of intellectual property, how to progress it and protect it. But through this process of getting deeper and deeper into the, it became a runaway train. He became indebted to many people. They started spinning the testimony, the patent. So the villain part was starting to misrepresent the facts and then starting to garner this political sympathy that he's been done, you know, he's not been given his due. But ultimately, Duncan, the fact that he was not the inventor, because, you know, recently one of the ministers said something like, Vodacom, shut up, right?
Yes.
Well, actually, the story really is put up your document that proves you were the inventor or proverbially shut up, because that's all that matters at this point. If you can't prove that you were the inventor, you don't have any legal right to compensation.
Yeah. Do you think this whole thing would have been avoided if Vodacom had simply manned up in court and been honest about who invented this thing and showed the patent?
Absolutely. And I was very vocal to them. I said, you are making catastrophically strategic miscalculation by thinking you can now undo promises that were made verbally when this has got nothing to do with that. Duncan, if they had said at the time, listen, You know, Kenneth, thank you for coming to us with your idea. It set the wheels in motion. Yeah. There's no doubt that his proposal did. But the train that left Vodacom landed up at the MTN headquarters. Mm-hmm. That's what happened. And if they had just said, you know, Kenneth, listen, it turns out that there was prior art. MTN had developed and claimed this already. We can't reward you anymore because it doesn't belong to us. Here's 50K for coming to us with an idea. Thank you. And that's done. That would have been done and proverbially dusted in 2001.
Why did Vodacom never do that? I mean, was it a matter of egos or was there something else at play?
I think which competitor would step up into the market limelight and say, oops, we copied our competitor. It's just not in the. I mean, look at Alanot Craig. You know what an unfortunate testimony that turned out to be.
Yeah.
But one thing Alan got right. Okay, one thing he did get right is he titled his bio "Second is Nothing," and in the realm of intellectual property law, first is all that matters. So let's just give you a slightly different angle for a second. Let's say there was no Khan in the picture. Let's say there was no MTN in the picture, right? Mm. Let's say Kenneth McCarthy dreamt up this new technology. Let's say he developed it. Let's say he did everything he claims he did, right? Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter, he still didn't protect it. Mm-hmm. So the moment Vodacom would have sent its first call me, the technology would have entered into the public domain. That means it's a complete free for all. So you can't have it both ways, Kenneth. You can't say the MTN didn't have the patent and it was mine and then say Vodacom must pay me for all the Vodafone group companies who adopted this technology, because after the first message was sent, it was publicly disclosed. Anyone could adopt it. Hmm. So I think his challenge is that he's a little bit naive when it comes to intellectual property, how the process works. And all he has to do... Kenneth, in his very own words, said, the biggest mistake of my life was failing to get a patent, right? Mm-hmm. That's quoting him. He is about to make the second biggest mistake of his life by not accepting this overwhelmingly generous offer, because when he takes this back to court under judicial review, he risks the new evidence that I'm telling you about, that the wrong patent was presented, that the court was misled into thinking Vodacom and MTN were different. No, that can all now be corrected, and he can stand to lose everything.
Yeah, which Vodacom could very well do, because Vodacom has been saying publicly now that MTN invented this. I think it was their head of chief of regulatory and legal affairs, Nyoka, who wrote in the Sunday Times a couple of weeks ago, admitting that it was MTN's invention, and other executives have subsequently said the same thing. So presumably, if this does go back to court, then Vodacom is going to enter this into evidence.
Yeah, you know, I acknowledge Vodacom 20 years later. I mean, Duncan, how to apologize in 9-point Helvetica in 900 words? Only a 900-pound gorilla could do that, right? But I acknowledge that they stepped up and they admitted, okay. And so that's the first step. Yes, I think he is risking everything. And while I absolutely, for all the reasons that I've articulated to you, he's not entitled to a penny, a proverbial red penny. But I'm also sympathetic to the human condition that he's finding himself in.
Yeah.
He's now beholden to all these investors who have bankrolled him. And I don't want people to suffer. And I don't want him to suffer. So the money that they're offering him will probably wipe out his debt, and you'll probably have a free lunch on the carrier. But that's where it should end. Because if it doesn't end there, this is the last exit on the call me highway for him. If he doesn't take that offer, he risks getting absolutely nothing. And that will be a tragedy on a second tragedy, honestly. Mm. It will ruin the guy. And I don't, you know, my view is that I have never spoken to him before. I've never spoken one-to-one. I don't know this guy. But I'm not his adversary. Mm. I don't wish this guy harm or ill at all. Funnily, actually to the contrary. I see a very bright guy that naively got entrapped and enmeshed in this tangle. Can you imagine the innovation that he could have come up with if he wasn't involved in 18 years of litigation, which consumes your life, right? Mm. I didn't look back to litigate. I looked forward to progress things. He unfortunately did a very different thing.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to try and get him on this on this podcast soon, maybe to talk about this stuff. I don't know if he is talking to the media or doing these sort of interviews, but it'd be interesting to get his take on it. And I do wonder whether he's in a situation where the amount of money he owes his litigation funders and other people is in excess of the amount of money that Vodacom has offered him in final settlement.
I don't think so. I think that there's more than enough there to clear his debt. I just think he still feels entitled to be richly rewarded. Yeah. But again, it's based on a false premise. So I think it's a blend of both of them.
Yeah. As a matter of interest, do you feel you should have been handsomely rewarded for coming up with this invention?
Not if you follow law, because I assigned this intellectual property over to the company. I don't have a claim. If anyone should have a claim, it should be me, and I'm not making the claim.
Yeah. Interesting.
As I said, you know, I looked forward. If you want to honor the rule of law, then that's the rule of law. You assign your, it was case law in the UK that says, even if you relinquish your rights, and if your invention delivers exceptional results, you have a right to further reasonable compensation. There was a doctor in the UK that developed a kind of a stent for cardiology, and he gave it to his employee. He had no rights, and it was a huge success. And he took them to court, and the court ruled that even if you don't have rights to your invention, if the company that deployed it earned exceptional results, it's fair that they recompensate you. But I'm not looking for that. Yeah.
So I wanted to just touch on Alan Knott Craig, the former Vodacom CEO. You briefly mentioned his testimony in court, which didn't exactly cover him in glory. I presume you've read his book, Second is Nothing. What is your take of what he wrote in that book about Please Call Me and his subsequent testimony to the court?
Well, two things. Firstly, he was very vocal in saying the MTN service was clumsy. I think that was his comment. Well, how clumsy was it? Let's have a quick look at that. You dialed three digits followed by a phone number, and you pressed send, right? Mm. The only distinction between that and Vodacom is Vodacom had a hash before you pressed send. The hash is what differentiates telephony from USSD signaling, surprisingly. That's all. You don't need the stars. The stars are just for a user presentation. So they were signaled identically, and I had made a decision very early on that I did not specifically want to use USSD. Why? Because USSD does not get recorded in your dial history. So every time you want to send a USSD, you have to manually type out the 20 codes.
Right.
But MTN was very elegant. MTN, you just pressed green to recall the last call, and you press green again. It was two clicks done. So it was more elegant, if anything. So he's feeling this whole notion that this MTN service was something inferior, clumsy, different, is pure fiction, right? His claim to inventing it unfortunately falls into the same genre. I mean, just for him to even contemplate that he would have come up with this idea watching two people from a distance, you know, I mean, honestly, it just is not intellectually honest, you know. So, but I don't have to beat him over the head. I think the markets or the public opinion have done enough of that. So I just think it was very unfortunate. But it does go to show that people make all sorts of claims. But if you, again, Duncan, if you want to claim the title of inventor, then you have to produce the record.
Yeah.
And the documents that sit in the patent office are no less factual legal documents than those presented in the court record.
So, Ari, where does this go from here? Do you, would you be prepared to testify in court if it came to it?
I actually did offer to testify Vodacom, but Vodacom were nervous that I feel Vodacom really felt legally vulnerable and exposed. They were kind of between a proverbial MTN space and an individual, and they chose to go for the individual.
Yeah.
Right. And I even offered to give them a deposition from the US.
Yeah.
And they kind of hummed and hawed, and they eventually decided, no, we're not going to go this route. We're going to go the contract law. We see how that turned out.
Yeah.
You know.
Anything else on Call Me, Please Call Me, that we haven't touched on that you'd like to, Ari?
My focus, as I said, yes, I actually would like to. There are a couple of very interesting angles to Please Call Me that after this wonderful hit, you know, I resigned my tenure in 2002. I stayed on for an extra 6 months at their request. I went and sat in the proverbial park. You know, Duncan, the funny thing about innovation, you know, like companies, they'll create these innovation centers, right? Mm. But innovation happens at the edges. So it's kind of a contradiction in terms. You can't innovate in the center. That's status quo. For me, looking at Please Call Me, it dawned upon me that there were problems with the service. One of them being that even the poor do not lack dignity. And Please Call Me had social stigma to it because it was kind of like an SMS begging bowl.
Yeah.
And not only that, it also degenerated into spam the moment they started adding adverts to it, because you'd have Please Call Me and then you'd get lost in funeral parlor notices. So it diluted, it kind of like diluted the proposition. You know, less is always more. If you just have a message that says call me, that is a very different message to call me and then get your latest funeral. You know, by the time you've gone through the message, you're not going to call someone. So that was like a worm they introduced into this beautiful apple. So the social stigma, the spam, every time you got a call me message, you had to open up your SMS inbox, you had to read it, you had to click call the number, then you had to go back and delete it. It basically frustrated the recipient.
Yeah.
So there were problems with it. Moreover, more importantly, call me happened after the fact for a lot of people. They'd run out of airtime. They would spin call me's, but there was a earlier, very, very nascent wave of behavior that was underlying call me that I came to understand deeper on reflecting. And that is people were actually miscalling, right? At the market extremity where prepaid users were coming onto the network, the networks have one major challenge today. Mm. It costs them more and more to get users who have less and less to spend. It's the proverbial law of diminishing returns.
Yeah.
And at the market extremity, people were ringing and hanging up.
Costing the network.
And that to me was a – well, I mean, they were also generating callback. But
yeah. The
phenomenal thing is, and if you allow me just a little bit of deeper philosophy on the network, is that in the very early days of fixed line – you picked up the receiver off hook and you put it on hook, right? Mm. On and off hook. Mm. Do you recall that days, right?
I do.
That was binary signaling, on and off hook, one and zero. And that was a major oversight in the grand design of telecommunications, was binary signaling, because all universal signaling systems have three states. They have red, orange, and green. They never just have red and green. Red and green is a bipolar disorder. It dawned on me one day sitting at a traffic light that the cellular network had missed the orange signal. It wasn't just because, you know, the industry became known as red and green, send and end, right?
Mm.
Talk and disconnect. And the on-off hook became the green and the red button. And what they'd forgotten was the state of orange, because all universal signalings have at minimum three states, but cellular only had two. So, I mean, Duncan, how amazing is this? How ingenious is the market? They wanted to do something other than just connect or disconnect. They wanted to connect and disconnect together.
Mm.
They literally painted orange by mixing green and red. What did they do? They pressed green. They listened for the phone to ring. They pressed red. Red and green make orange. They had discovered a way to signal something else that the network didn't provide them with.
Yeah.
And they'd actually leveraged a profound loophole in carrier billing, which says that you only get clocked when the call is answered. You don't get clocked on ringing. So missed calling became such a phenomenon that today one in four calls on networks around the world are missed calls, intentionally dropped calls to signal. So I spent the next 10 years developing a highly distilled and advanced switch that allows people to ring and disconnect in a single step. And that is now known as the star signal and the star switch, because the star key, funnily enough, was never used in telephony signaling. So what happens is people dial star phone number and they instantly send a missed call anywhere around the world in 2 seconds.
Now, this is your new business, Star Logic.
Correct, yeah. And this little switch, funnily enough, when I was in the very beginnings of developing, one of the greatest abstractions on the internet for telecommunications was the SIP protocol. Are you familiar with SIP?
I am, yes, but maybe for the benefit of our reader, of our listeners, perhaps explain it.
Okay. SIP it's a signaling protocol that allows you to set up a call from the internet. It's like HTTP is for the web that browsers use to connect and disconnect to a server. SIP is the same for telephone calls. And the phenomenal thing about SIP is it allows a one-man, two-man telco to originate a call from the cloud to any phone in the world without paying. You can ring any phone in the world without paying. That is a phenomenal abstraction. And in the very beginning days when I was developing the switch, I could do 10, 15, 20 calls a second, right?
Right.
Today, this little switch that we've developed can do 30,000 calls a second. It can do 1 billion rings a day. And again, it's one node, 100 servers sitting in the cloud, driving and controlling $100 billion telco network. That's a phenomenal multiple. And all on 5 free commands from the cloud. So we can support this little switch, this one little node, operating at 30 kilohertz, so to speak, 30,000 connections a second, can connect 100 million users. That's a phenomenal scale and distillation of a switch. I don't think it's ever been built to that level of scale before. And the vision here is that the next 1 billion people, you don't need to launch new networks like Google and Facebook. You know, they put up these internet flying machines and balloons putting 4G in the sky. Mm-hmm. You don't need a new network when the next 1 billion users are already living in coverage. You just need a new business model and a new way of doing things. So the notion here is to onboard the next 1 billion users with a free zero balance prepaid SIM. In other words, it's a SIM that costs you nothing, again, the penny gap. So it's free for you to get, a free SIM. And all you can do is you just dial regular phone numbers and the star switch spins these calls on your behalf. And the magic of the missed call versus the call me message is that it's universally understood. It transcends language and culture because the ring is a universal signal that everyone understands, right? And it's a language. It's actually the digital equivalent of Morse code. People ring in the morning, it means one thing. They ring 3 times in succession, it means something else. It's this whole protocol that's negotiated between the A and the B party. That's kind of like the primitive SMS. Right. Mm-hmm. So Star Logic is really about a star switch that sits in the cloud. You don't put anything on the network. You can enable any network in the world in 1 minute, and you can onboard the absolute zero balanced market. People who have no money or no disposable income, because today, Duncan, people cannot afford to feed a phone. You know, they can barely afford to feed themselves. And this will just be one less bill for them to worry about.
And I'm guessing, Uri, that you have patented the hell out of it.
I couldn't have said it better. Yeah, I mean, again, you know, without denigrating or just again being factual, you know, Kenneth McCarthy, patents 0, AK, patents 100. Yes, invested an untold fortune in patenting this around 50 jurisdictions around the world. Multiple, a huge investment for a startup. I mean, I've spent more on intellectual property than all the incumbents in South Africa have done collectively.
So where are you in commercializing this? When I presume you've had discussions with operators. Has it been deployed commercially anywhere yet? What's the rollout looking like?
It has been deployed. We commercial in Western African country. I won't put names right now, but I'll tell you what happened. Mm-hmm. So it's not viral to the extent that Call Me was, but it's kind of slower, more organically growing and will last longer. In the first 3 weeks, three and a half weeks, we had 1 million users, and we're just delivering our billionth ring. So the phenomenon, it's been absolute vertical takeoff. Because there's this deep desire in the marketplace for free communications protocol. This is the one lesson that the carriers did not learn with the over the top service providers.
Yeah, Facebook, Netflix, etc.
Yeah. The market wants free. They didn't get the message. Right.
Yeah.
And the carrier is in such a phenomenal position to deliver. What do they have? All the infrastructure you could dream of. They have the market, they have the handset, they have the technology. They just don't know how to innovate.
Ari, what's the revenue model here? Do you sell on a revenue share basis? So the callback party, you share some of that revenue with the operator, or do you just sell the hardware into the operators as a sort of an upfront sale? Or is it different in each case?
Well, it's two stages. The first is, here's the technology, look what it can do, look at the market's desire. But the true vision, as I mentioned to you, is to connect the next wave, the lost wave.
Yeah.
The wave that doesn't have a penny for you, and thereby create a new market segment. Because in 20 years, Duncan, there've only been two market segments, prepaid and postpaid.
Yeah.
It hasn't changed. And in fact, a lot of what the carriers do is just really play musical chairs. They just keep churning each other's customers. They're not growing the market. Because I think Bill Gates once said that zero is the most powerful number in the universe. But it's also the number that gives carriers night sweats, because you can plot the curves. Everything's going towards zero, right? And when there's nothing to spend, there's nothing to earn.
Yeah.
So this, I think the magic here is that you can reverse the flow of revenue without going to zero. We can take a carrier to zero profitably. And the market is saying to us, this is what we desire. We don't want you to tell us, cast the message in a text. We just want this ability to generically signal without social stigma. And it's been phenomenally successful in that room. Yeah, it's an exciting journey for us.
That sounds very good. So you left South Africa 15 years ago or so did you go straight to California? And was the idea of moving to California to be sort of closer to the epicenter of global innovation?
Yes, Silicon Valley always did intrigue me. I mean, you can drive down the 101 freeway in Palo Alto and you can just breathe in the essence of innovation.
Yeah.
You know, it just permeates everything. But the challenge is very few people innovate in telco. Here's one thing that I really came to appreciate is that the innovation is largely around the next shiny object, the next shiny app. But the truth of the matter is that technology evolves at the speed of light, but human behavior really goes at snail's pace. People don't like change. In fact, talking and texting today, we're just doing it in different guises because people love to communicate, right?
Yeah.
In Silicon Valley, in the so-called startup nation, people have a very, very short window of opportunity. If they don't get to market in 6 months, the opportunity is closed, but something else has taken its place. It's a frenetic pace.
Yeah.
You know. But telco is very, very compelling to me for two reasons. Firstly, you've got to have the stamina. This is an ultra marathon. You've got to have the stamina because the carriers turn, they're like oil tankers. They take 10 miles radius to turn, right?
Mm-hmm.
the cycles of getting into carriers, it can almost be exhausting, right? The time frame. But the difference is everyone thinks it's, you know, just get a new app out and own the world. But very few people truly understand the enormity of expense, cost, and energy it gets to acquire an app user base.
Mm.
That's why when these new internet startups, they raise $50 to $100 million is because it costs them $99 million to acquire their base.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But when you get it right in telco land, you can enable a core service in a network. You instantly enable 10, 20, 30, 40 million users. It's a completely different metric. And for us, I mean, the cost of acquisition is literally zero.
Yeah.
But yes, I think came to the USA because it's the land of dreams, right? But dreams can rapidly become nightmares in America. A lot of people can testify to that.
Hyper-competitive market.
Extremely. Mm. You know, the top 10 apps are in the hands of the top five global players: Google, Apple, Microsoft. I mean, it's an impossible pyramid to climb.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if you can comment on this, but have you had discussions with South African operators about deploying Starlogic's technology locally, and has there been any interest?
We are just about to engage with carriers in South Africa.
Okay.
And from our early discussions, there's extreme interest, yes.
Okay. All right. Ari, I think we'll leave it there. This has been a fascinating discussion. Thanks for taking us through some of the history of the Please Call Me matter and your pivotal involvement in the whole thing. It's going to be fascinating to see where this goes, and if Makate does go back to court, what the outcome of that is going to be. I think you've given him a message saying that he risks losing it all if he does pursue the legal options, but I guess he is in a bit of a tough spot. But thanks for setting out some of the background to this. I think there's a great deal of interest in South Africa in this case, and you know, it has become politicized, and a lot of people feel quite strongly one way or the other about it. So it's been very useful to hear this background from you. So thank you for that.
You're welcome. Thanks for hosting, and we'll speak again soon.
I'd appreciate that. Thanks, Ari. I really appreciate your time. It's very late in California, so thanks for staying up to chat to us on the Tech Central podcast.
You're welcome. Thanks, Duncan. Take care.